سلام علیکم و رحمت الله. بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. الحمد لله رب العالمین و صلی الله علی محمد و آله الطاهرین. Continuing from last night's discussion in relation to the identity of the man and that of the woman, and that we shouldn't be told which lifestyles are acceptable and which lifestyles are not acceptable from anyone but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It doesn't matter wherever you want to live, that's okay. But you have to make sure the lifestyle you adopt is that which is on a par with Allah's protocol. And we went through some examples in relation to the man and the woman. But there's a relatively new phenomenon that over the past few decades has gained a lot of weight in the West. And you know, sometimes one has to, on the pulpit, mention some arising issues that arise. These, through emails, I get a lot of emails on these issues. And therefore, on the pulpit too, it has to be raised now and again. And that's the LGBT community, which is lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual. I'll explain these in a minute. Not that we have a problem with any of them. As people, they are people like us. And maybe they may even be better in many cases. We're not judging who's better here. But our problem is when they force us to accept a particular lifestyle. We can never accept it. The more you compromise yourself in accepting such a lifestyle, even if you don't practice it, but you accept it, your descendants will suffer from it, and you would be responsible. No one is saying they are bad people. No. But this lifestyle is not on a par with Allah's protocol. And we don't have to accept it. Now, there are many sins like drinking alcohol or beating your neighbor out of anger or other sins where people are born with varying degrees of predispositions to various moods, to various appetites. Someone may have a stronger urge towards satiating their sexual appetite, their alcoholic appetite. Someone may be more predisposed to display anger than another person. When one is born with varying degrees of predispositions, and there's a degree of genetics involved. That's okay. These things are real. So, in the same way that drinking alcohol, hitting your neighbor, satiating certain appetites in the haram way, in the same way these are sins, we regard the LGBT, that lifestyle, as a sin too. And they're both sins, and they're both bad. Now, the reason why we socialize very freely with people we know who drink alcohol, Muslims, and who harm their neighbor or satiate themselves in the haram way, we're ready to socialize with them very freely. But with the LGBT, we don't. That's because of a taboo, and that's a cultural thing. Otherwise, both of them are sins. Both lifestyles are sins. Neither is better than the other. Neither sin. A sin is a sin. That shows our prejudice sometimes Otherwise, they're both people. As people, we like them. We don't attack them as people. But the lifestyle we don't accept. And we shouldn't accept. If you do, our future descendants, they're going to succumb to this. They're going to enter such acts. And you would be responsible. We would be responsible. And it's not problematic to say that one is born with a stronger or weaker tendency towards certain appetites of theirs or certain moods. It's a reality. We believe in spiritual genetics. We have so many we have so many ahadith where they say during conception, if the man is thinking of a particular thing, the child will be born in a particular manner, or will have a predisposition towards a particular manner. Actions of one's parents, grandparents, all these have a role. So when one is born with a whole variety of different predispositions to different things. But that doesn't mean we have to do it or practice it. That doesn't mean that it's justified to drink alcohol, to satiate your sexual appetite in X manner, Y manner, and so on and so forth. So they're people, that's okay. But the lifestyle is problematic and is a sin. Like with other things that are sins, we do not accept. And no one should force us. No one should look down upon us. And we shouldn't be scared either. You have to have your head high. Protect Allah's religion. Don't be embarrassed about it. But treat them as people. No problem. Speak with them. Socialize with them. Like you do with other kinds of people. Now, with the L and the G part of LGBT. Here the man has a male anatomy and a male psychology. And they're comfortable with their anatomy. And the psychology is male, but they're attracted to the same sex. With gays and with lesbians, it's a female. With female anatomy, with a female psychology, but they're attracted sexually to those of the same sex. I have to speak a bit more discreetly because for some reason tonight, there are many youth, many adolescents here, or even those of a lower age, so you have to bear with me a bit. So sex is a function of one's anatomy, or genes. If you're XX, you're female. If you're XY, you're male. Or one's anatomy. Once. But with bisexuals, no, they half of their lifestyle is okay. For example, they're attracted to the other party, but they're also attracted to the same sex too, and that part we don't accept. With transsexuals, the issue is different, and they're becoming more and more, even in Muslim countries, where the man has a male anatomy, but the psychology and gender is a function of one's psychology. Gender. The psychology is female. The anatomy is male. The psychology is female. And having a strong female psychology, it makes them very uncomfortable with their male anatomy, and therefore they go and have operations done. Then after the operation, the question is, do they become female?
And this has to be raised because this subject matter, sometimes, with all respect towards the marriage, of course, but sometimes you see in the mawzu, maybe the marriager hasn't understood the mawzu yet. And that's okay, because the marriager always gives the general rulings, like whatever intoxicates you, okay, you can't drink. It's haram to drink and it's najis. Okay, so whatever liquid that intoxicates, it's najis, even to drink a drop of it. That's a general ruling they give. Now let's say my marriage says Pepsi is haram to drink. And then you say, why? They say, because it intoxicates you. And then I have yaqeen that it doesn't. Do I have to follow my marriage in the mawzu'at? Especially when I have yaqeen that actually Pepsi doesn't intoxicate actually. Thank you for your advice. The advice is very good. It's okay to give advice and enter the mawzu'at, the particularities. But do we have to do taqleed in the mawzu'at? No, taqleed is only for the general rulings that they give. So if I was to drink Pepsi, it wouldn't be problematic. Now I know there's a discussion if it has 0.05% alcohol, but 0.05% alcohol isn't intoxicating, for example. Alcohol which is intoxicating is haram to drink and najis. But if you can, there's so many examples of alcohols that are not intoxicating because of the very low percentage. It's neither haram to drink nor is it najis. There's a difference here. And there are some foods are like that. In this question of sex change, sometimes I feel that the mawzu hasn't been understood as it should be. And this has some repercussions. And in medicine, there are many examples. I want to go over two or three of them that, although everyone follows their own marriage, but I'm looking at this from a particular angle. I'm not saying for you to believe it, and I may be wrong, but the angle that I'm approaching it is important for you to consider here. Anyway, we'll come to that in a minute. The question is now, with the transsexuals, which is also problematic, the issue is this. They have male anatomy, for example, but their psychology is female. There's a conflict between gender and sex. Sex being a function of one's anatomy, gender being a function of one's psychology. Whereas with the other groups, this wasn't the case. There wasn't a conflict between sex and gender. However, with the transsexual, they may be of a female anatomy and a male psychology. And that's also a conflict. Then they have an operation to conform the two with one another. They have an operation on the anatomy. They have an operation on the anatomy side so that it conforms with their male psychology, for example, the woman. But even with the transsexual, they are attracted to the same sex, even though the psychology is different. Think about that a bit. But anyway, the question is, with transsexuals, after the operation, that man with a male anatomy and a female psychology, now they have an operation, they excise certain parts, they incorporate certain hormones to conform with that female psychology. Does that man now become a woman? Does a sex change qualify here? And this is important because many of the maraji have given into this. And the maraji, they're not doctors, they're not specialists. They get information from the specialists. But the question is, those specialist doctors, they're not philosophers either. They have problems of their own. When giving that knowledge to the marriager, a lot of the problems we see today amongst the offices of the marriager is never because of the marriager himself. It's the information fed to the marriager. Many of the marriages just in a room. They have no access to the outside world. They don't even want access. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing. This whole idea that we need a marriager in the United States or in England, a marriager homegrown, that's wrong. That's never a criterion. But what is a criterion is that marriage has to be just, and the people working for him, feeding him the information, they have to be just people. And a lot of problems arise when those people aren't just. But let's not divert. So the specialist doctors, they give the information, and the problem is the information may be biased. Even in Iran, you'll find many specialists in these areas. They regard many of these perversions as normal. And they try to prove themselves medically to the best of their capacity. And they even regard the man with a male anatomy and a female psychology, they even regard them as female, as a woman, even their sex. Even, I'm saying even such countries. We have to be very careful here. Does this man, after the operation, become a woman? What does it mean to become a woman? Or does the woman, after the operation, become a man? What does it mean to become a man? Is it just because they've excised certain genitalia, now they're the other sex? Is that it? Or the other way around? Is it that easy? You see, the sex has changed? And therefore here, rather than just sufficing with the zahir, being a man, being a woman, these are takwini, natural cause and effects. These are biological realities. They have causes. And therefore, a philosophical understanding is important here. You can't just arbitrarily say, he was a man one day, now he's a woman. You have to base your statement and conclusion on facts. For example, Imam Khomeini, who would say sex operations is permissible, and therefore if it's permissible and they undergo it, then he would say now he has the rulings of a, if he was male, he has the rulings of a female, and so on and so forth. But at the end, he says all this applies if the sex change actually happens in reality. And the fact is it doesn't. But he gives 10 fatwas at the end of Tahrir al-Wasila, on this chapter of sex change. He gives the fatwas and everything, and at the end he says, this only applies if it really does happen. That if is a very important if. Now here we have to understand or base our facts on some kind of philosophy, on some kind of understanding of the cosmos, on the understanding of reality. You shouldn't give a fatwa arbitrarily, or you shouldn't be pushed or through bias be deceived to give a fatwa. Not that the marriage are deceived, but people are there to push them towards certain fatwas. Although the maraji are much more intelligent than that. But maybe in the future it won't be like that. The point is this, that we believe in a unity between the body and the soul. Certain body illnesses affects our psyche. Certain psychological illnesses affects our body. We believe in a unity. We only have one reality. It's me. This me has an immaterial dimension to it, the soul. And then this immaterial soul generates the physical dimension of me. The metaphysical soul generates the physical phenotype. And so the physical dimension of me, it's a manifestation of that immaterial dimension of me. But there's a unity between them. Modern medicine has proved this. This may have been a philosophy of 400 years ago or even more by some philosophers, but I'll explain why this has been proven even in modern medicine. So here, the soul of a man generates a male, masculine phenotype. Look, this hand, these legs, the head, ears, everything is a manifestation of my soul. Even my genitalia is a manifestation of my soul. If my phenotype is male, that soul of mine generated a male phenotype. And therefore, my sex is determined by how my soul generates my physical dimension. And therefore, I'm male. With gender, it's possible for gender to change. But if you're XX or XY, the sex won't change. There are exceptions, I'll explain that. That's also based on cause and effect. But gender, and that's why Islam has a lot of rulings on gender identity. Even for your 2 or 3 year olds, Islam says if it's male, don't let a female bathe them. If they're female, don't let a male bathe them. If they're female at 6, after 6, don't let a non-mahram touch or kiss them. Not that it's haram, but this is an ethical admonition. Be careful. Because here, or for the male, Islam says when you buy them gifts, buy them male-orientated gifts. For females, female. For females, adorn them with female things. For male, dress them in a masculine manner. From 2 years of age, we have these rulings. Sometimes you may see a 3 year old when you go to someone's house, they've put makeup, nail varnish, for example. They've colored them. It's a 3 year old. And a small necklace over their neck. That's good. You're establishing that female identity in that sister, for example. Or with males in another manner. So here, you see that in Islam, it's important because the gender can be susceptible to change by environmental things. That's important. Maybe after a particular age, 7, 10, 12, we don't know exactly, different for everyone. After a particular age, gender is almost impossible to be reversed. But sex from the very beginning, one sex can't be changed. If you're XX, you're XX. If you're XY, you're XY. And the soul is generating this XY phenotype or XX phenotype. Just because you cut a part of it, it doesn't mean the soul is now not manifesting that male phenotype. Just because you've cut a part of the body. And the same with women. Okay? So if you have a man with a male anatomy, the soul is manifesting that, and he's a man. The sex is that of a man. They'll never be a woman. No operation can make them a woman. And the same with women. when you excise a body part, and let's say you replace it, or you add a body part to yourself, that body part which you've added to yourself, depending on the degree of the so-called sex change operation, that body part that you've added, it's not yours in the taqwini sense, in the real sense. It's just an added part. Like, for example, you add a prosthesis, for example, on you. That prosthesis is not in unity with your physical body. It's not a generated thing that your soul is generating. Like the soul generates the hand, the legs, the head, everything. This prosthesis is not a generated part. There's a disunity between the body and that prosthesis. Look, for example, in a kidney transplantations, just looking at the time, yes. When you receive a kidney in a transplant operation, why does the patient who receives the kidney, why do they have to take immunosuppression until the rest of their life? Because their soul rejects that alien kidney, doesn't recognize it. It's never theirs, meaning it's never in unity with them, the patient. What does it mean that it's never in unity with them? It means the soul is never generating that. Here they're just using the blood supply and feeding that kidney off the patient's blood supply, but they suppress the immune system of the patient, so the soul never recognizes, never rejects that alien kidney. If you don't take immunosuppression, the soul will keep on rejecting that kidney and the patient will die. Even if you have a small heart valve operation, where the heart valve of an animal's heart, use it like with pigs, for example. Here, you put it into the patients, they have to take immunosuppression until the rest of their life. It's not theirs. It's not in unity with them. They're not generating that valve. But it's good to have these operations because the person will live, for example. That's okay. But what about with uterus or womb transplantations? This is important now, because the woman is the mother, is the owner of the womb. Let's say you're a woman and you receive the womb, the uterus of another woman, and it's transplanted into you, a woman. So the womb you have is a transplant from another sister. This womb that has been transplanted into you, is it yours? To paraphrase, is it in unity with you? To paraphrase, is your soul generating it? The answer to all three is no. And therefore, even if you were to give birth with such a womb, it won't be regarded as your child in real terms. And therefore, you won't be the mother. Because it wasn't in unity with you. There was no generating of that womb. It was just like a machine, like in ectogenesis, where you have a machine. It's not a reality yet, but from the very beginning, the embryo is in a machine, for example, the whole 9 months. But that machine now they've put into your body, for example. It's never in unity with you. It's just something added. Or when ovaries are transplanted or testes are transplanted into you. Okay? So someone else's ovaries, someone else's testes. Now this gives rise to egg cells or sperm. Is it yours or is it someone else's? Here, the Furahosam may very simply say that since it's gone into your body now, all regards it as yours. I'm not saying they're wrong or anything. I'm not at that level at all. But I have the right to question something here. That here you say, after the ovaries have been transplanted, or the testes, or the womb has been, Orff would say it's theirs now. So if they were to use those ovaries to give birth, or the testes, or the womb, it's theirs, child. Is this based on a real philosophical Taqwini system? Or is this arbitrary? The rulings in Islam are based on reality, on the Taqwiniyat. It's a famous saying the Urafa have. The Tashri'iyat are based on the Taqwiniyat. The rulings in Fiqh are based on real cause and natural cause and effects. Things that are really happening. They're not merely arbitrary. And so here, you see, so many things arise that we have to be careful when, you know, giving these rulings. So with the kidneys, it's not a problem. But things which determine fatherhood or motherhood, it becomes more of a problem. It's not only an operation. We want to see if kinship results or not. Is that an arbitrary call or a taqwini call? Okay. Now, someone may raise a dilemma and say that sometimes we have someone who looks female, but they are XY. Okay, and you said XY, the sex is always male. But when you look at them, they're all female. Or someone may be female, but they're XY. Or someone may be male, but they're XX. This, they may bring cases, and they're right. Such cases do exist. But the point is this. When we say XY determines the male sex and XX, that's, we're only saying that in general terms. On the Y chromosome, there's one gene. That gene is important. That gene in an XY is located on the Y chromosome. And sometimes that gene is called the SRY gene. It can be mutated and inactivated in that XY person. And therefore, they will have a female anatomy. Don't, just because they have a Y chromosome doesn't make them male. What makes them male is the active SRY gene. Sometimes in XX who look male, but they're XX, that SRY gene, which belongs to the Y chromosome, cross-links, moves to the X chromosome. It doesn't matter. The criterion isn't Y-ness. It's the SRY gene. Where is that? Is it active or not? You tell me where it is, if it's active or not, I'll tell you if the sex is male or female. Look, these dilemmas are always, you know, increasing day by day. They're pushing for this agenda to say these people, it's all normal. And then they're teaching this. This is part of that 2030 I was mentioning. They want to inculcate this in us. And therefore, these issues have to be mentioned. Yes. Okay. Now, since I mentioned this organ donation thing, just on that, I'll just end with these two points, and tomorrow we'll start a different discussion, inshallah. Sometimes these points have to be mentioned. That with organ donation, there's another problem we have. And most of the marriage accept it, given the circumstances. It saves life, the quality of life, and so on and so forth. Most of them say you can only donate, if you're a Muslim, you can only donate to Muslims. There are one or two, very few. It doesn't matter. So if you have the organ donation card, you're safe there. It doesn't matter. Even if your organs were to go to a non-Muslim, that would be unproblematic. But most Maharaji don't accept that, including Ayatollah Sistani. He doesn't accept your donating your organs after death to non-Muslims. There's one problem, though, that this donating of organs, which is becoming very fashionable, even in Iran, they're propagating it, they're advertising it, how noble it is to do. Okay? I don't have a problem with that. The problem is this, that there's no informed consent. In medicine, before you do an operation, there has to be informed consent, where the patient gives consent, but the consent the patient has given was based on the patient initially being informed of everything that may or may not happen and what is going to be involved here. That's okay. So they want to have a cholecystectomy, for example, take their gallbladder out. They're told everything. They can say no. They can say yes, but they're given all the facts and the risks. In organ donation, we have medical informed consent, okay, no problem. But that, since they usually donate it after death, once the question of death arises, here the ulama enter. The spiritual doctors enter now. We tell the medical doctors, thank you up to death. After death, medicine has no jurisdiction what happens. The spiritual doctors know what happens, because they've studied the texts. The medicine and medical doctors, they can't give a say here, and they shouldn't. What happens after death is that when someone who's accepted for their organs to be donated, when they open the body to take their organs, will they suffer or not? Ayatollah Jawadi Amoli, in his tafsir, he said, for most of us, when we die, for a period, we still think we are the deceased body. We still think that that body is us. And that's why with doing the kafan, the enshrouding of the mayyit, and all the ceremonial aspects of in relation to the mayyit, the kafan, the salat, the hunut, and so on and so forth. With all these, do it with care, do it with respect. Disrespecting the body is haram. Has even a blood money assigned to it, depending on the harm you do to it. Why? Don't put anything heavy upon it. There are so many rulings. The rationale behind these rulings is because the soul still thinks they still think that body is theirs. They think it's them. If you put something heavy on them, they will suffer. They will suffer. That's the point. If you hit their body, the soul will suffer. Now, when you operate to get their organs, did you tell them there's going to be suffering involved? Look, why would they never donate when they're alive? They can still donate a kidney, for example. Why? Because they're scared. They're scared to give a kidney now. Maybe because the other kidney will go or whatever, but they're not ready to go through that pain. What makes them think that they won't be scared after death? This opening of the body. Look, I'm not saying don't or donate your organs. It's a very noble thing. But if it's done with informed consent, do you know it's going to cause you harm? Even when a heavy book is placed on the mayyit, it causes the mayyit harm. Even when, after death, a thread of hair is separated from the mayyit, it's wajib to bury that thread of hair if the hair disassociated from the mayyit after death. Not before death, in the hairdressers. That's okay, you can do whatever you want with the hair there, even though it's mustahab to bury it. But it's wajib to bury that thread of hair that was detached from the mayyit after death. You have to bury it with him. Why? Ayatollah Jawadi says, there's a strong sense of attachment to the body still. The soul has a very strong attachment to its body. The detachment has not resulted yet, even after death. Yes, for the awliyaullah, it's resulted. For them, it doesn't matter what happens. They're totally detached. But for most of us, no. Now here, you're cutting them up, taking their organs. I don't have a problem, but did you tell them? Did the doctor that is going on television, propagating this, enriching this so-called culture of organ donation, are you informing the masses though here? And another problem is brain death. What classifies as death? That, inshallah, another time. I don't want to make this too medical. I'll stop here. Tomorrow we'll start another theme, inshallah. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala ta'ala. Okay, now, continue with the poems of Oman Salmani. <clears throat> 60 years ago, in the office of Ayatollah Marashi Najafi. You must have all heard the name. I never had the chance to see him. But the name, I'm sure you've all heard, in Khiyabun Iram, where his library is, and he's buried there too. 60 years ago, in his office, he held a fateh. And people would come in that ceremony, Fatiha, Suratul Fatiha ceremony for those who usually pass away. They hold a Fatiha for them. And then they were all, you know, there, and it was finishing. And then some people said, well, there's no photo or anything here. Who was this Fatiha for 60 years ago? He replied, it was for Za'afar. Said, who's Za'far? He said, Za'far is a jinn. This jinn passed away today. Because with jinns, they have a very long life expectancy. Although in some cultures, they've taken this jinn thing to extremes. Every burden that happens, they think they've been attacked by jinns, or whatever they see, which they can't commentate upon, they quickly go to jinns. That's a good leeway to solve their problems. Now, jinns have nothing to do with us. They're in their own realm. We have nothing to do with them. They have nothing to do with us. Some people are ordained by Allah to make use of jinns and transact with them. That's okay. Like Nabi Sulaiman. Some people may illegally try to gain access to jinns. These people will end with a bad fate usually. But some people like Ayatollah Marashi Najafi, he's one of the very few exceptions where he would be in contact with jinns in a halal way. He said Za'far, the jinn, passed away today. Who was Za'far? Za'far was the head of the jinn army, who on the day of Ashura in Karbala went to Imam Hussein and said, let us sort this out for you. We can do it. This army of 30,000, we can destroy them over time, no problem. That, he was called Za'far. This is in the Maqtals too, the story of Za'far. It exists. And Ayatollah Marashi say, look, he died today. We give him a fatiha. Now, he was a very just, trustworthy person, Ayatollah Marashi Najafi, in ways more than one. Oman Salmani now goes through this event in Karbala with Za'far through the eyes of Mukashafat and metaphysical unveilings. Now, I'll go through it line by line, and let's see where this will get us. Inshallah, we'll try and finish this tonight. Arifi guyad shabi az ruye hal, dashtam ba Za'far az ghayrat su'al. One night there's an Araf. He doesn't say who it was. Usually the Arafah, when they speak like that, it's them. Usually, not always. So always be prepared for that. There's an Araf who one night was awake one night out of his own, the Arif's own zeal and ghayrat. He had many questions posing to Za'far for himself. He said, why did Za'far do this? Why did Za'far do that? He had many questions. The questions arose from his zeal towards religion. Now, these are his questions he had. He was questioning himself in relation to Za'far. خسچه اول رخش همت پیش راند و آخر از مقصد چرا محروم ماند. That this Za'far, in the beginning he went to help the Imam with all his army. So why didn't he reach his aim? Why was his objective suppressed? Why did he fail then? Why didn't he do what he was supposed to do? The Arif was saying this to himself. راحتی در خلد پرزیور نکرد، بر لب کوثر گلویی تر نکرد. And therefore, since he wasn't successful in doing what his objective was, to save Imam Hussein from that army with his jinn army, he said, by doing this, he didn't get to his heaven, that luxurious heaven of his. He didn't moisten his throat with the water, the pool of Kothar. By not doing this, the pool of Kothar didn't come his way. These are the Arif saying these to himself. Gam zan dar saye tubi nashud, hamnishin jinni bikarubi nashud. He didn't stride into the shadows of the Tuba tree in heaven by not doing what he was supposed to do. He didn't be in the vicinity. He didn't become into juxtaposition, close to the heavenly celestial figures by not doing what he was supposed to do. So why didn't he do it? راست گویند این که جسم ناریند بی نصیب از فیض لطف باریند. Is it true when they say that these are made out of fire, the jinns, and therefore as a result they're not granted that divine grace of Allah to be granted upon them? Is this true? با خدا جویان نبود همدردیش یا که آگاهی نبود از مردیش. His objective was not on a par what he wanted to do. It wasn't on a par what the shuhada, the 72, wanted. This is the Arif saying this. Did he care for the shuhada? So why didn't he do what he was supposed to do? Or rather, does he know what it means to be manly or not? Does he know what it means to have valor or not? Tosahar چشمم از این سودا نخفت، دل به غیر از شنعت زعفر نگفت. Until sahar time, my mind was preoccupied with these questions directed to Za'far, and I was only thinking of the vice, the negative aspects, the ugliness of Za'far's action of not doing what he was supposed to do. بعد از این سحرم چو پیش آمد سحر، شد بیابانی به پیشم جلوگر. As he approached the sahar time with all these preoccupations, thinking, all of a sudden he undergoes the arif. He undergoes a vision. He has an apparition. The metaphysical realm opens up to him. And now he's seeing, not with the physical eye, he's seeing with the same eye that when we sleep. But he's not asleep. But this vision opens up to him, as if Allah wants to give him a message now. جلوگرشد در برم شخصی عجیب. From now it's a vision. From now to the very end, if he's explaining the Arif, he's explaining this apparition, this vision of his. Appearing before me was an extraordinary figure. با تنی پرهول و با شکلی مهیب, with a body very fearful and with an appearance that I'm scared of. بر سر خاکی که در آن جای داشت با سر انگشت نقشی می نگاشت. He was residing in a particular place, on a particular desert, because in the vision started with a desert opening before him, and there was someone in that desert with an extraordinary attire. And then on the desert, with his finger, this extraordinary entity wrote something on the desert, on the sand. بعد از آن آن نقشی را از روی خاک با سرشک دیدگان می کرد پاک. And then that thing that he was writing on the sand became faded away by means of the tears of the cries of that individual. He cried so much that the tears faded that what he wrote on the sand away. پیش رفتم تا که بشناسم که کیست, همچنین آن نقش را بینم که چیست. In this vision, the Arif, in the vision, metaphysical reality, he said, I went, it's like in our dreams, for example, I went close to see who he is and what did he write. همچنین آن نقش را بین, چون بدیدم بود آن نام حسین, سرور دین پادشاه نشعتین. I went to see what he had written Hussein. It was in the process of being faded away by the tears of its eyes, but he had written Hussein on the desert sand, the leader of religion, the king of the two realms, of the dunya and the hereafter. چش بر من برگشود آن نیک نام. That entity then turned towards me and his eyes were directed towards me. کرد بر من از سر رقبت سلام. And then he greeted me with a salam, with very openly. پس جوابش داده گفتم کیستی که تو از این جنس مردم نیستی. I said to him, who are you? Because the stuff that you're made out of is not the stuff that we people are made out of. گفت, then that entity replied to the Arif in the vision. گفت دانم من که شب تا صبحگاه با منت بود اعتراض ای مرد را. I know, he's saying this to the Arif, I know that you, until the early hours of the morning, you were attacking me and going against me and faulting me, O traveler to God. زعفرم من که از سر شب تا سحر بود با من اعتراضت ای پدر. I am زعفر. In this vision it was زعفر. I am the same زعفر that you, the Arif, until the early hours of the Sahar, the morning, you were making faults directed towards me. با تو گویم حال خود را شمی تا که یابی آگهی شردمی. Okay, I will now tell you, give you a scent of what happened on that day. I will tell you so that you become aware a little of what happened that day. بهر جانبازی آن شاه از ولا چون شدم وارد به آن دشت بلا. I went to the plains of Karbala. I went there to give my life away for the Shah, the king of religion, out of love for him. I did this. چار فرسخ مانده تا نزدیک شاه محشری بود هر طرف کردم نگاه. And when I went there to see my king and to support him and give my life for my king, Za'far the jinn is saying this. Where the king was, if you imagine a dot and then a radius of four farsakhs from each side of the king, it was mahshar, it was resurrection time there. He explains what this means. The whole assembly of different people were there. Mahshari, no, jam, yeksar anbiyavo awliya, asfiyavo, askiyavo, atriya. So, surrounding the king in Karbala, four farsakhs, each direction, there was mahshar. An assembly of all kinds of people. It was resurrection day, as if. And they were all prophets, lovers of Allah, the refined ones, the pure ones, the people with taqwa. Ruh pakan, khak gham bar sar hame, tiq bar dast o kafan dar bar hame. The pure souls there, it was as if they were pouring the dusts, the sands of sorrow on their head. Swords in their hand, all of them wearing kafans. جان ز یک سو جمله خاصان عرش زیر سم زلجناحش کرده فرش. The celestial figures, all of them there, they had laid themselves like a carpet, those celestial angels and figures, they laid themselves like a carpet for the horse of Imam Hussein. This shows their love for Imam Hussein. تن ز یک جا جمله نیکان خاک بهر ضرب ذوالفقارش کرده پاک. And the earthly figures there in this vision, they had also laid themselves down for the ذوالفقار to kill them, saying, you know, please kill me. This is being, it's a metonymy, kenaye, meaning that I am at your service no matter what, even if my life goes. So the celestial figures give their life. The earthly, the prophets, the pure ones, everyone, they're ready to give their life. It's a mahshar. It's a resurrection there. جسته پیشی خاکیان زفلاکیان همچنین افلاکیان زخاکیان. In this yearning to give their lives for Imam Hussein, to give their existence for Imam Hussein, the celestial ones wanted to overtake the earthly ones. The earthly ones also wanted to overtake the celestial ones in this regard. پای تا سر از جماد و از نبات در سراپای حسینی محو و مات. All the inanimate things, stones and everything, all the vegetative life, all of it, giving their existence, being absorbed in, being annihilated in one particular Hussein. جرأت من جمله صفها را شکافت یک سر مو روز مقصد بر نتافت. Then Za'far is continuing. Then man, my audacity, my valor, then through this four radius assembly of holy figures, I, with my army, I went through the rows of these earthly holy figures. I charged through them. I didn't see who it was. I made my route to see the king. از تجری من و آن همراهان جمله را انگشت حیرت بر دهان. This audacity of mine and my army charging through the rows to get to the king, it led everyone to be bewildered. Hands in their mouth. Who is this? What's happening here? تا رسیدم با کمال جد و جهد بر رکاب پاک آن سلطان عهد. Until with utmost severity and striving, I reached his holiness. The king of the pledge, that pledge of, on the first night we mentioned what the pledge was, meaning Imam Hussein here. I reached him. مظهری دیدم از آب و گل جدا، از هوا خالی و لبریز از خدا. I saw a manifestation empty of earthly dimension, empty of air. It was all filled with Allah. It was all Allah manifesting.
کرده خوش خوش تکیه بر فرخ لوا، رو بر او پوشیده چشم از ماسوا.
He was happy, in ecstasy, lying against a valued flag.
رو بر او، with Allah, facing Allah, with his eyes turned away from other than Allah.
He was annihilated in Allah. He was absorbed in Allah, the king, Imam Hussein.
دست بر دامان فرد ظلمنش، دست یک سر، دست یک سر ماسوا بر دامنش.
He totally relied upon the owner of favors, on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But other than Allah, everyone was relying on Imam Hussein.
بسته لبهای حقیقت گوی او، او سوی حق روی و آنان سوی او.
He had closed his lips towards Allah. His lips were silent. He was facing Allah, drowned in Allah. Everyone else there, they were drowned in him.
محو و مات حق همه در ذات او.
In some texts it says در ذرات او. ذرات او.
That annihilated and absorbed in Allah was every particle of Hussein, was drowned in Allah.
جمله ذرات محو و مات او.
But other particles, other than everything else, all those other things, inanimate things, animals, people, everything, were drowned in Hussein.
گفتم ای سر سر خیلی مستان السلام، مقتدای حق پرستان السلام.
I said, Za'far is saying this. He reached the Imam. He said, O leader of the intoxicated ones, salam.
O leader of the worshippers of Haq, salam.
As salamam didegan ra baz kard. Zir lab ahistam avaz kard.
When I gave the salam, the eyes of Imam Hussein opened. He was drowned in Allah. It opened. And then he spoke with me in a calm voice.
گفت ای دل داده برگو کیستی، ان در اینجا از برای چیستی.
امام حسین said to زعفر، O lover, why are you here? Who are you? And here, what are you doing here? What are you here for?
امام حسین said to زعفر. گفتم ای سالار دین زعفر منم، آن که در پای تو بازد سر منم.
زعفر replied and he said, O leader of religion, I am زعفر. I am he who's ready to lose my head, my life for you.
And then زعفر continued, آمدستم تا تو را یاری کنم، خون در این دشت بلا جاری کنم.
I've come to help you, support you, and to spill my blood in the plains of Bala, in Karbala, the plains of burden.
Then Imam Hussein, با تبسم لعل شیرین کرد باز.
Imam Hussein smiled, his lips opened.
He saying to himself, Za'far has got the wrong picture here. He's misunderstood everything.
با تبسم لعل شیرین کرد باز. گفت ای سر خوش، ای سر خوش ز صحبای مجاز.
He smiled, Imam Hussein, after Za'far said what he said, opening his lips, and then he said, someone who is ecstatic from the allegorical wine, not the real wine.
You've become ecstatic. It's made you come here.
But this ecstasy was because of you drinking the allegorical, majazi, unreal wine. So Zafar, the decision wasn't perfect what he made. Why? چون نباشد پیر عشقت راهبر کیز حال عاشقان یا بی خبر. O lover, O Zafar, yes, you're a lover, but since your ustad wasn't a true mentor, when can you ever be aware of the state of the true lovers of Allah? You're bi khabar, you're totally unaware of what true lovers go through, because your mentor wasn't a true mentor. خود تو پنداری در این دشت بلا مانده ام در جنگ دشمن مبتلا. You, Zafar, do you think in this plain of bala, do you think me, Imam Hussein, a lover of Allah, do you think I am afflicted with these burdens that you've come to me? عاجزی از خانمان آواره ام نیست بهر دفع دشمن چاره ام. Imam Hussein continues, you think that I'm here captivated and left all alone with my family, and you think that me fighting them is the only thing left for me? Is this how you view the lover, the true lover? در سر عاشق هوای دیگر است. In the heads of the lovers, it's another story altogether. خاطر مردم به جای دیگر است. The people, when they see something, because they're limited and ignorant and unaware, they make a wrong conclusion. Otherwise, for the lovers, it's a different story. نیست جز او در رگ و در پوستم بی خبر از دشمنی و از دوستم. It's only Allah filling every part of my body. I am unaware of enemy and friends, because he's annihilated in Allah. Imam Hussein, من ندانم دوست کی دشمن کدام. ای عجب این را چه اسم آن را چه نام. I'm annihilated in Allah. Burden after burden that happens makes me closer and closer to Allah. I'm annihilated in that state. I don't give labels to people that he's my enemy, he's my friend. What have you thought of me? What have you taken me for? He's saying this to Zafar. Do you think I'm like you? اینک آن سر خیلی خوبان بی حجاب بود با من در سؤال و در جواب. Before you coming, I was with Allah, unveiled with Allah, with question and answers between me and Allah before you were here. با هم اندر پرده رازی داشتیم گفتگوهای درازی داشتیم. There were secrets between me and Allah. It was unveiled, there was no veil between me and him. There was a dialogue between me and Allah. هیچ کس از راز ما آگاه نبود. No one was aware of the secrets between me and Allah. در میان روح الامین را راه نبود. Not even Jibreel was in between or was an intermediary. It was direct between me, Imam Hussein, and Allah. چشم از او پوشیده کردم بر تو باز. And then you came and said salam. I turned away from Allah, and then my attention turned to you. As haqiqat rakht bastam bar majaz, turning my side from the haq and turning towards you, the majaz. Khud tu digar az koja peyda shudi? Where did you turn up from? Where did you come out all of a sudden? Parde cheshme man sheyda shudi, and by coming out of nowhere, all of a sudden, you acted as a veil between me, my ecstasy, and Allah. Why did you come here? این بگفت و دیدگان برهم نهاد. He said what he had to say, then he closed his eyes, he went in that state
of annihilation in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Arzha kardam javabam ra nadad. I kept on insisting, asking further things. There was no more reply. He said what he said. And Za'far, he insisted. He said, let me help you, please, this, that. There was no reply. Then Za'far ends. Raj'ata man. My returning from Karbala, not helping the Imam. Zon rekab a muhtasham. Me returning from the Imam Hussein, O respectful one, that was always faulting me the whole night and saying, why didn't he do what he wanted to do? Yik jo as sa'ye shahidan nist kam. It's not a one grain. What I did was with pure intentions, with effort. It wasn't one grain less than the endeavors that the shuhada had. But it wasn't meant to be. And this is the point, and the poem ends here. When you're annihilated in Allah, your actions, your words are Allah's actions. You don't need an army. You don't look here and there to get help. It's all Allah in function. And Karab wa Bala, it had to happen the way it happened. And no interference, even with the best of intentions, it would be replied by the Imam of the time as, what on earth do you think you're doing? Let God act godly. وصلى الله على محمد وآل الطاهرين.